Blog Talk Radio.
Live on the Sports Geeks Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. I am your host, Vito Cherko, and on the show today with me and right now is my co-host and Five Wide Sports founder and owner, Kyle O'Connor. Kyle, welcome. How are you today?
Doing well. How you doing, Vito?
Very good. Very good. And we have a lot of topics to cover today on this show. Let's first start off, though, Kyle, with some Patriots off-the-field troubles. Specifically, Alfonso Dinard arrested on suspicion of DUI this past week. Now, with Aaron Hernandez committing the murder allegedly and being tried now for that, him and Dinard getting in trouble off the field, does it mean, Kyle, that the Pats have a problem inside the locker room and possibly, to be specific, a character problem with their players that maybe they can't get totally under control like they have in the past under Bill Belichick?
I don't think it's necessarily a character problem within the team. I think you may see them take less chances on character guys in the draft. They've always had the philosophy that they can take a guy, they can straighten him up no matter what his issues are. Obviously, it's looking like it's not the case. Because you're not talking about guys that had clean backgrounds, clean past coming into the Patriots, and then turning into troublemakers. So I don't think it's an issue in the locker room. It's Aaron Hernandez had issues in the past. Alfonso Dinard had issues in the past. And both of them just haven't been able to get over it. So you may see a change of philosophy moving forward in the draft and free agency. Maybe they don't take on some of those projects like they used to.
And Bill Belichick used to be comfortable in Robert Kraft of allowing Belichick to take these guys, as you said, were character problems, and slipped in the draft to the third, fourth, fifth round of the draft because of their character issues in college and attitude problems, off-the-field troubles from the past during their college years and maybe also high school years. So now, does that change, like you said, the Pats' philosophy going forward with their draft and their draft methods, where they take guys and where maybe they don't now because of all these off-the-field troubles?
Right, yeah. I think when you look in the drafts coming off of guys off the top of my head, you know, such as Denard, Janoris, Jenkins, you know, kind of guys with checkered backgrounds, they I don't think they're going to mess with them anymore. You know, Belichick has a big ego. Maybe he does. Maybe he still wants to take these chances. But, you know, it's coming back to bite them. They're going to lose about, probably when it's all said and done, about $15 million on Aaron Hernandez. Denard started their playoff games last year at corner. I assume they're eventually going to cut him unless what he says is absolutely true, which is hard to believe. So I think they're going to have to be safer in the draft. And if they do take guys like this, it's going to have to be how they did with Haynesworth and such, where it's later on a minimum deal, maybe if they go undrafted, and then they do their homework a little bit better before they give them extensions.
And like you said, they've made it work in the past with guys like Haynesworth to a degree. Obviously, Randy Moss, too, and they acquired him from the Raiders. He was great in 07, had that historic offensive season for Brady and the Pats overall-wise, and Randy Moss became the top connection for Brady in the passing game, too. So he was great all year long back in 07. A great under-the-radar deal. I believe they gave up a fourth-rounder to acquire the rights to Moss, and that worked out terrifically for the Pats. Other guys in the past, high-risk, but low budget deals, under-the-radar deals, assets they had to give up that weren't really that valuable in terms of draft picks or maybe just salary-wise, what they had to pay to get these players. Now maybe the philosophy has changed for the Pats, as you said, Kyle, going forward, even on these veteran and more proven players, unlike Denard.
Right. You look at another recent one is Ocho Cinco. They brought him in one season, I think he had one touchdown, really didn't play a role. But again, with guys like that, when you're talking about veterans, where you don't necessarily have to waste a draft pick, you bring them in for the minimum, that roster spot has to be filled anyway, and then you can cut bait with them at any time. I think in the draft, as well, to be more conservative, they can still take shots on guys that don't have a team, that are a lot more lower risk. It's a situation like Aaron Hernandez where you really don't want to see happen. And even Denard to an extent, you know, that was a good young corner for them. They always
he looked really good last
help.
Season at times for the Pats, I would say.
He was. And they need secondary help. So to lose him would be a pretty big blow.
That's their biggest weakness, I believe, on their roster as a whole right now, Kyle. And it definitely hurt them last season all year long was their Achilles heel, and it got the best of them, I believe, towards the end of the season because – you know they have the offensive attack through the air, that aerial attack with Brady and all his offensive weapons in the passing game. But it also comes down to getting stops when you have to in crunch time. And the Pats would struggle here and there last season, and really in recent memory, at stopping opposing teams' passing attacks. And now without Denard, a young corner that you could have maybe built around as the Patriots. Now without him, and the loss of him from their secondary, what do they do going forward in that secondary, which, like you said, is a weakness that they have to improve on?
Well, they'll probably have Khalid back. They got him on the cheap last year. He's a really good corner. And then their high draft pick from a couple of years ago who can't stay healthy, Razai Dowling, he's going to have to be good. They don't really have much else. I assume they're going to go out. If they do cut Denard, I assume they are going to go out and look for a corner, maybe look for some veteran corner help. But, you know, it's going to be a question mark yet again. We'll have to see what they can rile up. But, you know, I never count out Belichick. He'll figure something out.
And they have to cut ties with Denard at this point, correct? He's been arrested not just once, too, but twice, which leads to the question of does the NFL have an image problem, too, with all these recent arrests? Specifically, Titus Young, also of the Lions, 11 times arrested already within the past year. And now Aaron Hernandez of the Pats. And now, most recently, Denard of the Patriots. Him being arrested twice, though, but most recently, I believe, in the last week. Now, that means he has to be cut, though. Back to that question, correct?
I would cut him. And I assume Belichick's going to cut him also. I mean, if it was a first-time thing, you'd maybe give him a little bit of leeway, but when he's been that way in the past, I mean, he punched an officer in college. I mean, that's obviously not the best judgment. Even if he says he didn't fail a sobriety test, he was still drinking, he's still on the road, and he knows in his situation, in anyone's situation, you shouldn't drink and be on the road, obviously, but in his situation, you definitely couldn't, especially when the NFL has a program that will come pick you up. It's completely anonymous, and they have the money to pay for that. Or just
yep.
give me a $10 cab. I don't understand, and it's a horrible judgment. I would cut him.
And what's the mentality, Kyle, of these players nowadays in the NFL and in all professional sports, baseball, basketball, hockey, but specifically the NFL in recent memory, these players getting in trouble, drinking and driving when they could have just, like you said, hired a cab driver with all the money they make with their salaries and where they currently stand, among even minimum wage guys in the NFL, as you might refer to them as, the lower caliber guys in terms of talent and maybe in terms of years in the league, like a Denard. He still has enough money on him on a daily and nightly basis to get somebody to come and pick him up. There's no excuse for what he did, like you said, Kyle.
He has plenty of money. You compare the minimum guys in the NFL. Even practice squad guys have plenty of money, especially when we're talking about a cab. And it's just ridiculous. A lot of them just have the mentality they're not used to being told no, almost an invincible type thing, where
mm-hmm.
you know they think they can do whatever they want. A lot of it does stem from college football, which doesn't prepare them the best in a lot of big time programs, and they just think they can get away with it. I think they need stricter DUI penalties in the NFL. Josh Brent, you look at him, he was drunk, he killed a guy, one of his teammates, and he was down on the sideline the next week.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
It makes no sense, right? How he was allowed
no.
to come back on the sidelines and to cheer his team on, to be there for his team. He should not have been allowed, by any stretch of the imagination, to be there for his NFL squad in the Cowboys. The week after, right? After committing that crime, killing somebody.
Correct. Yep.
What a horrible thing, and the NFL just allows that to pass themselves by and to permit him to be on the sidelines, to be involved with NFL activities once again. And that short period of time, too, after it happened, makes no sense to either of us. And stricter rules, penalties have to be instituted and implemented going forward for the NFL. So I think be perceived as a strict league and as a league that has credibility going forward, Kyle. Because they definitely have an image problem right now with their players.
They do.
And how do you fix that, though, going forward? It has to be the stricter penalties that get implemented, right? And for all 32 NFL teams, it has to be consistent, too, throughout. From the bottom players that are just roster or practice squad players to the top-of-the-line guys that are franchise players and getting paid top dollar.
Yeah, I think it has to be stricter penalties. I wouldn't be against, if you get caught driving drunk, that's a one-game suspension. Right then and there, no questions asked. You're an NFL player. There is no excuse for you to be behind the wheel. There's no excuse for anyone to be behind the wheel while drunk, especially an NFL player with all the money they make, with the program the NFL has set them up with. It just boggles my mind that they still do it. So I think it would be a one-game suspension. You lose pay for that game also right off the bat, and then you can go from there. Whether you want to go up to 5 games, 10 games, season. For other arrests, obviously you need to get the whole story, but, if it's an arrest, where even if it's a misdemeanor, felony, just start suspending players. You take them off the field and hit them in their wallet, they're going to get the picture sooner or later.
Yep. They'll definitely, I think, get the picture then, the full picture, and realize what they have done is wrong and that they have to improve on their character issues and get better as individuals off the field too. Become better people, reliable people in outside football activities. And I think key to that is the stricter penalties, like you said, and suspending guys for multiple games, I believe. Even a first offender that gets charged for DUI, I think you have to give them a suspension of at least 4 games. And then it becomes greater and more severe as a player does it more and more often. So for a second-time offender, 8 games, maybe a third-time offender, 12 games, or the whole season at that point in time, if it happens a third time, because 3 strikes, you're out, no matter what sport it is, regardless of baseball, no pun intended. If you do it 3 times, commit a crime like that, you should be suspended and lose your privilege to play in the NFL, at least for a season, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you just look at your everyday person. What happens when they get caught 3 times driving drunk? You know, they're in jail, first of all. A lot of them don't have the solid lawyers that NFL players have. And I'd be fine with what you said, a 4-game suspension first time. I just don't think that would be a battle with the Players Association to let that go through.
That wouldn't really fly, right? So maybe 2 games. Instead of 1 game like you propose, maybe
would,
2 to make it multiple games.
You could even ask 4, see if you could compromise it 2. But you have to start suspending guys, because as long as they just keep getting little fines from the league, fines from their team, and most teams aren't the Patriots, most teams aren't going to cut a guy that they need. They're not gonna get the issue, and they're just going to keep doing it.
Now, how about the Pats and the state of their franchise? Image now that they have as a franchise, has it been ruined and at least deteriorated from where it used to be, where they used to stand as a model franchise that Robert Kraft allowed Bill Belichick to build in past years through the draft, through free agency, through trades with quality, classy players? Has that gone downhill? Has that been deteriorated by these recent arrests of past players in Denard and also Hernandez?
The Denard is, as bad as it sounds, it's kind of a run-of-the-mill arrest. I don't think that is too much of an issue as far as a team image. Hernandez is obviously huge. I mean, you have a guy that could be a serial killer, and he was playing tight end for you, and he gave him an extension. I mean, that could be the one that really hurts their image. I mean, Aaron Hernandez is going to be a huge name. I mean, we still remember Ray Caruth and Boone associating with the Panthers.
Yeah.
And it's Aaron Hernandez was a bigger name than Ray Caruth. And, you know, it's just that's something they're going to have to work hard to get over. And that's another reason I think maybe they don't take chances on guys. I think they're going to want to distance themselves from situations like that as long as possible.
Now let's move on to some more NFL news, but some quality, positive news now, at least for Matt Stafford, getting a contract extension for 5 years, and at least $41.5 million of it will be guaranteed money from that 5-year deal given to Stafford. That will see him earn $76.5 million over the next 5 seasons. Is Stafford, though, as a franchise QB now, I would say, for the Lions, worth all that money that the Lions devoted to him over the next 5? I believe he's very close to that as a franchise caliber QB. And I guess in this day and age, you got to pay a player to get a player to make him stay with your team. But I want to see more consistency, less erratic throws, and more W's overall going forward for the Lions.
I agree. I mean, he has times where, you know, he can be a little iffy and make you scared, but I think he's worth the money. I think I'm a lot higher on Stafford than most. I think he's really good. You know, he does have issues with his mechanics at times. Sometimes his drops are sloppy. You know, he won't really play it off his back foot when he throws. He'll throw sidearm even sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not all Calvin Johnson why he's putting up numbers. He's actually has a higher completion percentage to receivers other than Calvin Johnson. And you got to look. This is a guy, basically, he's thrown for 5,000 yards the last 2 seasons. That's really, really hard to do no matter how much you throw, who your receivers are. And to be honest, he hasn't really had a second option outside of Calvin Johnson that a lot of other quarterbacks, you know, get to have. You've had, you know, Titus Young for a while, and he was okay. Nate Burleson, if you want to count Brandon Pettigrew, Tony Scheffler. I mean, none of those names are jumping out at me.
No.
You know, Calvin Johnson's seeing at least cover two coverage the whole game. Usually he's going to see a third floater in the middle of the field. And Matt Stafford still throwing for 5,000 yards. I think he's worth the money.
He throws for big numbers, big yard totals for sure with Calvin Johnson. Great chemistry with him right now in the passing game for Stafford and the Lions. But I want to see more out of him, less erratic throws like I was noting on, and more consistent mechanics, less sidearm throws, because those are scary and lead to INTs, which he racked up a ton of in this past season for the Lions, a thing he has to limit and reduce going forward for the Lions to be an efficient, balanced attack, which also means more of a running game and consistent ground-and-pound attack from Reggie Bush in the ground game of the Lions going forward, which could happen with the addition of Bush. But we still have to see it to believe it, especially myself as a Lions fan.
All right, and that's another thing that Stafford hasn't really had a luxury of. When Jahvid Best was healthy, you know, they clicked a lot better when they had a home run threat back there. So LeSean, I'm not huge on LeSean. You know, he's not going to break tackles. He's not going to be a home run threat. He's just going to do what he does. He'll get you solid carries here and there. And that Lions offense, you need a guy like Best or who they have now and Reggie Bush. And, you know, you need explosive guys like that. You need guys like that that are versatile. Their draft pick from Notre Dame is Theo Riddick, I really like, too.
Well, you love your Irish guys. I know that, Kyle.
Yeah, I think he's in the mold. He's not as athletic as Reggie Bush. But what for the Lions are trying to do, I think he's going to fit in really well. He played receiver at Notre Dame also. That will come in handy. And I think Stafford's going to have another huge year. And you got to remember, last year, Calvin Johnson was tackled inside the 3-yard line 5 times. The Brandon Pettigrew was tackled inside the 3-yard line 3 times. So if they get in, how different does Stafford's numbers look? I mean, they would have been ridiculous. So, you know, it's a game of inches, and usually that stuff will swing the other way, law of averages, the next year. And I think he's going to be in for a big year. And I have no issue with that money.
And like you said, the Lions finally have a home run hitter out of the backfield in Reggie Bush. And even a guy like maybe Theo Riddick or, in my opinion, especially Jahvid Best when healthy, I think he's still able to do that just maybe in certain spots on an occasional basis. Because you can't expect that out of him to be consistently doing that, especially because he's not healthy enough. His health is always a red flag. Never able to stay healthy for the duration of a 16-game regular season. As a result, Bush was added. So now, even without Jahvid Best in the backfield, you have Reggie Bush to hand off the ball to, who can really, really lead to some big runs and be that home run hitter in the backfield like you were touching on, Kyle. And that's the difference right now between the Lions' offensive attack from last year and this season, in my opinion.
I agree. And, you know, even if Best, you know, a Best-like player gives you 5-6 touches just to open things up, LeSean can, you know, still in short yardage situations when you're trying to pound the ball a little bit more. Reggie can be the all-around back. You know, he needs probably 15 to 20 touches a game. And then the younger guys you have coming in, like Riddick, even if he doesn't really get many touches, just to keep defense honest, motion him out of the backfield, you know, give him a couple draws here and there. I think Stafford needs versatile pieces around him, and he's going to have a lot of versatile pieces around him next year.
And he's got a great arm. There's no doubt about that. There's no debating it that he has a cannon on him. So he can throw it anywhere on the football field and throw those deep passes consistently with accuracy. And that's the key with Stafford. He can do that, but it's the other throws too, and when he gets away from his mechanics, like we noted on, too, Kyle, and maybe adding a more consistent, reliable second option to a secondary receiver behind Calvin Johnson, who is Megatron for a reason, a great wideout, a number one wideout, and perhaps the best one in the game right now with his ability to go up and get the football against all and every single defender imaginable in the NFL right now. So we've got him and the connection there in the passing game, but it's that number two guy, having that guy that consistently gets it done. But is there a guy in the Lions roster right now that can step up and produce as a number two wideout option in the Lions passing attack this season? I'm concerned about that because I believe they don't have that option in their passing game because, like you said, Burleson, a great veteran, is more of a third target, along with the tight ends of Pettigrew and Scheffler. Much better third targets in the passing game than, realistically, number two guys. That step up when Calvin Johnson is double-teamed and maybe can't get the football for some reason, which realistically barely ever happens for the Lions.
I agree. I think really the only hope they're going to have is the hope someone like Ryan Broyles comes back healthy and can be that guy. I think if he stays healthy, he can be that guy. He has a lot of talent. He has a lot of talent. You know, one-on-one, he's going to be the corner probably every time. With him, obviously, it's help keeping him healthy. And, you know, like you said, the tight ends, I really like Pettigrew. I think he's a really good player. Scheffler's also solid. Other than that, I mean, the receiver, you don't have much. You mentioned Burleson. He's more of a three. He works better in the slot. Mike Thomas works really well in the slot. You know, he could get some touches, but he's going to have a lot of weapons. You got to remember Reggie Bush is basically a wide receiver. Notre Dame. Oh, Theo Riddick is basically a wide receiver.
Your boy Riddick,
Yeah, he's basically
a wide
receiver.
Is he that Bush type of back out of the backfield that can catch those dump off passes, you think, and make a big play out of nothing?
Oh yeah, his he played wide receiver 2 years at Notre Dame and was really good at receiver. And last year with Sierra Wood and George Atkinson, they probably would have moved him back to receiver if need be. He was just too good running the ball, so you couldn't. But I would expect him to probably catch more passes than get carries in Detroit.
And Bush is that great receiving back, like you said, out of the backfield. You can dump it off to him and expect him to be able to break tackles with his elusiveness and
right.
his legitimate speed, too, out of the backfield. That's the addition of Bush and what he brings to the Lions and their ground attack, and even in the passing game, like we both noted, Kyle, for the 2013-2014 NFL regular season, which will need to be a better defensive season for the Lions as a unit. That's really the key to them maybe making a run at the postseason this year out of the very tough and balanced NFC North.
I agree. Defense, and especially the secondary, is going to have to play well. I like their linebackers are good enough. I love their defensive front. It's going to have to be the secondary. We saw, what was it, last year? In one of their muscling games, we saw Aaron Berry just be an absolute mess trying to cover receivers. And that's kind of been their issue at corner. You know, they have a lot of young kids. I like Chris Houston. He's not bad. Other than him, you know, that secondary is going to struggle. And they're going to have to stop passing attacks, especially if they're playing with leads, which with that offense they probably will be. So that'll be their big issue.
Yeah, it still looks pretty bad on paper, talking about their secondary, which was definitely their Achilles heel and weakness all season long last year. And it did them in. It was the reason why they missed out on the postseason and finished 6-10 instead of 10-6. Not being able to stop the passing attacks of the Packers, the Bears, even the Vikings in the running game, within their division, all those teams with the good passing attacks. It got the best of the Lions. And hopefully they improved on it enough through the additions of Quinn Glover and bringing back Chris Houston, a veteran who got it done for the Lions in the past. Maybe with those guys, some veteran presences, the Lions can get it done defensively enough to allow their offense to score the points necessary to win football games this season and enough to get into the postseason, at least as one of the two wild card spots in the NFC.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't have any issues with predicting them to make the playoffs. You know, anytime you have offense that explosive, it's definitely a possibility. It's just the NFC North is so tough. The Packers are obviously going to be right there again. The Bears are going to be good if, you know, everybody stays healthy. The Cutler, Forte, Marshall, now even Alshon Jeffrey, you know, that's a good little offensive core. The Vikings, I probably expect them to take a step back this year. I think you can only get away with bad QB play for so long.
Yeah, Ponder definitely has to improve, right, for them to make it back to the postseason, even with AP in the backfield.
Yeah, and you remember, they lost Percy Harvin, they got Greg Jennings. Greg Jennings is a different kind of player, though. Percy Harvin could come in the backfield. He really caused defenses problems. But I think Adrian Peterson will probably have a tougher time this year as well. They're going to need Cordarrelle Patterson to step right in and have a huge year right away, which I don't think could happen. So I would probably expect them to take a step back.
Yeah, I do as well. I do with their quarterback play. Has to improve Christian Ponder. If he does, maybe they have a chance to make it back to the postseason in the NFC. A tough conference right now, Kyle. And another reason why it is tough is because of the 49ers in the NFC West with Colin Kaepernick as their QB, the man under center for the 49ers, going into the immediate and also long-term future, it looks like, for the Niners. Now, the thing is, he came under some turmoil and receives a public outcry, I would say. Definitely some dismay from fans of the 49ers organization after posting a picture of himself with a Miami Dolphins hat on his head, Kyle. Did it lead you to question, though, his character as well and maybe make you shake your head at the same time about Kaepernick?
Honestly, I couldn't care less what hat he wears, especially with the younger kids now. And they just wear whatever hat goes with their outfit. That's
yep.
what he was doing. I really don't care. I can see some diehard Niners fans really getting worked up. But, I mean, I'm a Colts fan, and if Andrew Luck was wearing a green and yellow jacket and wanted to wear a Packers snapback to go with it, I wouldn't care. He doesn't mean anything by it. I mean, the guy's not a Dolphins fan. He's just wearing the hat that goes with his outfit.
I don't get why kids and teenagers and, you know, young adults do that nowadays, though, with hats, when they don't even know the team's players, aren't even fans of the teams that they wear the hats of. I don't agree with that and understand that with young people nowadays, including my peers as being only 20 years old myself. I see it a lot nowadays with my friends, kids I go to school with at UDM, Detroit Mercy in Michigan, and just people around me when I go out and see these people wearing hats, such as Colin Kaepernick, a young person like that, who is not a fan of the team he's wearing the hat off. I know it matches your attire, looks good with what you're wearing, but come on, man. I mean, why? Why do you feel the need to wear a hat of an opposing team, especially when you're in the NFL and a high-caliber player playing QB for the San Francisco 49ers? I just don't get the need or the urge of Kaepernick to do so in the public eye. Makes no sense to me.
I'm of a different mindset. I couldn't care less. I mean, I'm not going to go around wearing hats of like Michigan hats or Cardinals hats or White Sox hats.
Well, that would be stupid for you, right, as an Irish fan.
Yeah, but I mean, neutral teams, I mean, I probably have 40 hats. And I have, you know, I have a Dolphins hat, I have a Bills hat. I don't care what they wear, if it goes with their outfit, if it's a team they like or not. I mean, it's just a hat. You can let them wear whatever he wants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could see maybe he's wearing like a Raiders hat or something, or even like a Seahawks hat or Rams hat.
A rival hat, right.
You know, maybe get worked up, but I mean, it's mm-hmm. the Dolphins. I don't see any problem with it. He's still a kid. He's just in the spotlight. I would just say let him wear what he wants to wear. It's not his job to not offend Niners fans. He's out there helping them win every Sunday. I mean, if they play the Dolphins in week 5, it's not like he's going to play any less hard.
It's not like he's going to give them the football right on purpose because he wants to see the Miami Dolphins win instead of his own squad.
Right. He's still going to play hard for the Niners. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a business. You know, he is a 49er. Obviously, he wants 49ers to win right now. But I tell you, when this contract's up, he's going to go to whoever offers him the most money. So he's not attached to the Niners at all.
There's no loyalty right nowadays, especially among young players in professional sports. And maybe Kaepernick, the same thing with him. Maybe he's that type of player as well. But back to my point, as a player in the NFL, when that's your paycheck on a weekly basis, how you're earning your income, and you're wearing a rival's hat. Now, he wasn't, but if you are, or just another opposing NFL squad's hat, to me, it's not right. There's no reason for it whatsoever. Now, as a fan of the NFL, now, you're a big-time fan, right, yourself, of football and the NFL,
right.
Correct?
Hopefully,
so you can wear whatever hat you want, a cool hat of another team that maybe you don't root for that much. But the thing is, with you, Kyle, you're a big sports fan. You know the players of opposing teams anyways, so I'm fine with that. But these kids that just wear hats when they don't even know the players on those teams that they wear the hats of, that makes no sense to me. And that's where I have the beef with normal everyday people and teenagers and young adults, such as yourself and myself as well. That's my beef with those type of people, the average Joes that walk around with hats of all these teams from the NFL or baseball. And then with the NFL players, I have a bigger beef because Kaepernick is making a big paycheck from the 49ers, or will very shortly, most likely. And he's wearing a Miami Dolphins hat. Just doesn't make much sense to me, and I wouldn't have done it. I'd be wearing all 49ers gear. That'd be the team that I would love and be loyal to, for right now at least. They gave you the shot to start in the NFL, so you better stay loyal to them and do whatever you have to make it look good that you are truly a fan and member of this 49ers team. That's my opinion, though.
Yeah, I mean maybe. I mean, it's a different mindset from college. In college, you know, everybody wears all the gear. They have the free gear. In the NFL, I mean, it's just, I can't tell you how many NFL players I've seen out and about that are wearing other team stuff. I mean, Tom Brady wears Yankee hats. I don't think that goes over too well.
It wouldn't look good, like LeBron James when he wore that Yankees hat. But they're free to root for whoever they want in other professional sports leagues, right? When they're not playing baseball, they can root for a baseball team from another city that's not from Massachusetts, that's not the Bo Sox, when it's Tom Brady wearing a Yankees hat. They're free to root for whoever they want to because they're not playing for the Red Sox.
Right, but I think if
that's
you
the
ask Jed York, I think even if you ask Jed York, if you ask Harbaugh, you know, what are your thoughts on him wearing a Dolphins hat, they just laugh. I mean, it's a hat. If he's wearing a teal
it's really not
shirt,
a big issue, right?
I understand people think it's a big issue. I think it is the biggest non-issue on the planet. It's a hat. Like I said, he's not going to go out and give the Dolphins the ball if he's playing the Dolphins. If he's wearing a teal and orange shirt, off the top of my head, there's only one hat I know that would go with it, and that'd be a Dolphins hat. And, you know, I'd have no issue.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to match the attire, right, and look good in public, I guess. Hey, I guess you're free to dress up with whatever clothing or whatever hats you want to wear to make yourself look good, right? And that's what he was trying to do. No offense to opposing fans or to the 49ers organization and their fans. He didn't mean anything by it, right? He had no intention of pissing off fans and the team and the higher-ups of the 49ers organization and Jed York and all these other guys. He had no intention of that, so it shouldn't be a big issue.
Yeah, he had no intention to make anybody upset, and the only people he did make upset were the fans. Like I said, the front office, the coaches, I promise you that they don't care. He can wear whatever he wants. Fans will get upset, but that's the nature of the fan. They're going to get upset like that. I said, personally for me, if I saw Andrew Luck wearing a Packers hat, if I saw him wearing Texans are in the division, a Patriot, another red, any team that's not a rival, any team that's not in the division, Packers, Bears, a Lions hat, a Rams hat. If he wants to wear it, wear it. I don't care. I know on Sunday he's going to play as hard as he can to win for the Colts.
Realistically, it's a non-football issue, and it's time to put this discussion to an end. And honestly, if you wear a Lions hat, I'm fine with that because I love the Lions. So when it's your team that the player's wearing the hat of, hey, it's all cool, right?
Sure.
So. Well, we do have another caller on the line with us right now, and this is Mr. Bernstein of 5 Wide Sports, an NBA contributor for 5 Wide. Welcome to the show. How are
you
today?
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. I'm doing good, thanks.
Good. Good to have you on today with Kyle and I. And let's get into some NBA topics now, specifically looking first at the Cavs, Jordan, and their decision to sign Andrew Bynum, who missed all of last season for the 76ers after they acquired him in a three-team deal in which Dwight Howard was sent to the Lakers. Now with the Houston Rockets, Bynum's gone from the Sixers, now playing for the Cavs, signed to a two-year deal, and I believe only worth $6 million in guaranteed money, and the second year of the contract is a team option.
Definitely,
now,
I like it.
For you hearing that, Jordan, is it a good deal for the Cavs going forward?
I think it's definitely a good deal for them. They only risked $6 million, and I'm a huge Bynum fan. I mean, I was a big Laker fan, so he won a couple chips with us. And, yes, he hasn't played basketball in a year, but if you can even get, like, I don't know, 80% out of what he was, I mean, that's a steal for $6 million. I mean,
now, Kyle O'Connor, what are your thoughts? So, a good deal, too, for Bynum?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, worst-case scenario, you sink $6 million into him. You know, if he comes back to anything close to what he was, you have a top five center. And that not only will that be big with Kyrie, Anthony Bennett, for instance, Thompson, Deion Waiters, in 2014 when they have a lot of space, they'll be able to lure a big name, maybe LeBron.
LBJ,
you know,
back
yeah,
in Cleveland.
He's never played with, you know, a stud center. He had Shaq past his prime, and really that's the next best center he's had is, I can't even think of anyone
big
off
Z.
the top of my head. Probably.
The Drunas, Ogaskis, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Best next center
maybe,
after Shaq.
Maybe him. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that would be big for Cleveland. And even if they don't get LeBron, you know, that's still a nice little team with Kyrie, Waiters, Bennett, and Bynum.
Yeah,
and
I
a healthy
Bynum,
that's the
know.
Key, too, if he's healthy.
Oh, yeah. I think that's I think they can make the playoffs and be, like, a solid, like, probably like a 7 seed. I could see Washington creeping up there this year as well.
Yeah, I believe they're an 8 seed, guys, with a healthy Bynum, along with Deion Waiters, Kyrie Irving, a budding superstar at the point guard position. And I believe a top-5 player already at his position, as we talked about on Twitter a few days ago, Kyle, this past week. I believe a guy that you can build around for the future and that will be a superstar very soon and is on the cusp already of being that type of player. So sliding him alongside LeBron James in a year from now, think about the potential of that team, along with Deion Waiters, Tristan Thompson, Anthony Bennett, maybe even Bergeau, plus a healthy Bynum. That's a legit playoff contender in the Eastern Conference and a top team in the Eastern Conference that can possibly beat the Heat, too, with a true center that the Heat don't have and a true starting point guard as well with Irving.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, go ahead, Jordan. You take that.
I was going to say, well, were you talking about if they get LeBron? I think if that team gets LeBron, they're the favorite to win the championship.
Yeah, I mean, forget the Heat, right? Because the Heat would have D-Wade, maybe Bosch too, and then a bunch of veteran backups and some young players that might be good one day but aren't absolutely starters right now.
Yeah, if LeBron leaves, the Heat and Pat Riley's going, or they're going back into a rebuilding mode if LeBron leaves. They got all their choice.
If LeBron leaves the Heat, they're a 6-7 seed.
They're a middling playoff team, right, that might barely get in. As that 7th
Correct.
Seed or maybe even an 8th seed and just barely get in.
They're kind of like my Lakers right now if LeBron leaves.
Yeah, the Lakers look ugly right now, Jordan. I know you love the Lakers. Kyle told me about it. And, man, do they look bad. Kobe's hurt to start the season. No Dwight Howard. Artest was amnestied. Who do they have to build around right now?
Nick Young.
To build around the easy.
That was a lovely contract, right? A 1-year deal for the guy that shoots teams out of games.
Who are you talking about, Nick Young?
Yeah, I think he does.
Yeah, the Lakers haven't had an athletic guy who could score for himself since, God, I don't even know when. And
how about Kobe Bryant?
It'll bring at least some excitement to games. I don't think we're going to be very good this year, so I'm all right with it.
Now, Kyle, your thoughts on the Lakers as they're currently structured and whether or not they have to legitimately start building for the future.
Yeah, me and Jordan have spent tons of time talking about this, and I don't know if you read Bill Simmons' last column, how he would fix the Lakers, but I absolutely agree. I would, as long as you have Kobe around, you're going to be a mediocre team, which is what you don't want to be in the NBA. I would completely blow it up. If you can move Nash, you basically have a zero salary cap going into 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And
you got to move Powell, too.
Yeah, you have to move Powell as well. And then you probably have a bad enough team to where you get a top-5 pick and a loaded draft. That's the way I would go, but they're not going to do that because they're not going to piss off Kobe.
Yeah,
but like you said, they should
happens.
Build for the future. They should gain future assets and try to tank it possibly this year to get an Andrew Wiggins in next year's draft.
That'd be ideal.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you could get rid of, like, Kyle and Nash for a few bad expiring contracts, that'd be perfect, but there's no way they're going to do it.
And Nash is past his prime anyways. He's 39, right? Almost 40 years old now. He's not an MVP or all-star caliber starting point guard anymore. He is not that Nash of old. And even Gasol has lost something. I still think he's a solid big man, and that's why, you know what, you trade him, though. Get something in return for him, right, while he's still worth something. And same thing with Nash, even. He's still worth something.
Yeah, I mean, I think he'd be worth a lot to Toronto, too, just because he's a Canadian guy. So I feel like you could get some expiring contracts out of Toronto if you give him Nash.
Yeah, and Toronto still has Rudy Gay, DeMar DeRozan. They got rid of Bargnani. They still look like a good team that could possibly make the playoffs this year with an improved season from Gay and DeRozan. And then with Nash as a starting point guard, now I know his health might be a little bit of an issue at this point in his career, but still with the hometown connection, like you said, that'll look great for the Raptors on paper at least.
I mean, and at least fill seats, that's for sure. People would love to come see Nash in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. And how about Canadian hoops as a whole, too? That country, man, they're taking over. They beat the U.S. in the U19 tournament, right?
Yeah.
That happened yesterday
definitely.
With the lights turning off on the U.S. squad at the end of the game. And that was something to see. And now they got Wiggins coming, might be a number one pick, back-to-back number one picks. That would be something for Canada.
Canadian picks, definitely. I mean,
yeah, U.S. sent a bunch of bums over there, though.
Well, I saw McDermott was playing. I saw him. Who else was playing in that tournament?
McDermott was playing. I saw Luke Hancock. Louisville was their leading scorer.
That's not a good thing.
No, he was the fourth, fifth best player on Louisville.
Yeah. He's a quality supporting cast member.
Right. He's a good shooter.
Now, Jordan.
Yep.
Looking at the Cavs roster right now, what are they? They are a playoff team, right?
100%. I think they're a playoff team. I mean, Bynum, he's an 18. I mean, he'll give you 18 points, probably 10 rebounds in his prime. So if they get, 70% out of him and just get like a double-double out of him every night, that's a playoff team, I think. Especially with the bottom of the Eastern Conference, how it is.
How weak
it is. Kyrie Irving, I think – he is a superstar. I don't think he's, like, on the cusp, but I think he's a superstar in this league now when he's healthy. So, yeah, I think if they miss the playoffs this year, it'd be a failure for him.
Yeah, I think Irving's a top-5 point guard already. Now, does that establish him as a legitimate superstar, though, already in the game? We know he's a legitimate all-star point guard, Kyle, but is he a superstar at this point in his early career with the Cavs?
Well, if you're going to put him as a top-5 point guard, then he's put ahead of some guys that you would consider superstars. So I think you'd probably have to consider him a superstar. I think next year, by the end of next year, I think we're saying he's a top 2 or 3 point guard. I wouldn't be surprised with 25, 8, and 5 a night. He's a stud. And like Jordan said, those bottom 3 spots in the East are going to be up for grabs. You're going to have Cleveland, Washington, Detroit, Toronto,
my Pistons,
Milwaukee.
Showing some love for Motown.
They're all going
to be bad. I like Josh Smith, what you guys did.
Yeah, I think so too, depending on what they do now at point guard. Is Knight the answer going forward at point guard? I think Billups will help out too, mentoring him. And even Mo Cheeks. He kind of had a large influence on developing Russell Westbrook in OKC as an assistant coach for the Thunder. So maybe Knight can get it done as a starting point guard. But
we still have to wait and see regarding that, in my opinion. I like what the Pistons did. I still think they're, that one all-star player away from really making, a crack at the Eastern Conference. I think they're still a really good player away from it. If they could snag, like, Rondo out of Boston, maybe, I'd really like
that. Oh, that'd be lovely.
Right.
But that's probably not going to happen, too. I think Danny Ainge wants to try and make it work in Boston with him and see if Stevens and Rondo can coexist and mesh first. And then if Rondo proves to be a problem for Stevens in Beantown, I think then he gets shipped out of town. And maybe then the Pistons can offer up a deal good enough involving Greg Monroe to land Rondo in Motown. And then you have your starting point guard.
My question is Vito, what position are they going to play Josh Smith at?
Well, it's got to be the small forward right now if he's starting, and he better be starting with the contract he's making. And Monroe and Drummond are still very good starters themselves. And Drummond is a guy that might even be better next year, probably will be, with a full season under his belt. An additional one where he stays healthy and even improves on his game and his craft overall-wise. I believe he's a legit starting center because of that. And Monroe is pretty much a double-double machine, too, already at this point in his career. So Smith, then, is a starting 3, in my opinion.
Right.
Until they deal Monroe.
I think, but if you're starting front court, if you're going to start Smith, Monroe, Drummond, which they should and will, your shooting guard has to be lights out. You have to have a shooting guard that's going to spread the floor.
And Stuckey's
those guys aren't.
He's not.
No, he's not. He's not.
Chauncey will help you. Chauncey could still shoot.
Chauncey will help Knight develop as a point guard. And Chauncey could knock down some shots for the next year or so. He has a two-year deal with the Pistons. But
yeah,
I don't think he starts at shooting guard. With the money that Stuckey's making on his contract currently, you have to play him as a starter at the two. And
yeah, I agree.
They are much better off, though, if they get a proven shooter in there who can score a knockdown outside buckets to open it up for the guys down low in the front court. That's the key to the Pistons, but Stuckey's not that guy that can get it done like that. He's probably a better reserve at this point, and I think he'd be a quality reserve, honestly, on a contender. But he's not a starting two guard, and honestly, he's not a starting point guard either. He's proven that, too.
Yeah, he's like 20 minutes a night now at this point in his career, which I think is fine.
And he can be good, though. When he gets hot, he's pretty darn good at getting to the rim and finishing. He's not too bad of a ball player, but he's not a quality starter on a nightly basis.
I agree. What do you think of their small ball lineup, though, if they put Monroe at center and then throw Smith at the four? I kind of like that.
Well, they can really run it then. Get out on the fast break, force turnovers, much like the Heat do. And if their defense is close to what the Heat produce with LeBron and their boys, their big three in Miami, then the Pistons can be something of value and maybe be
like
a playoff
it.
Team.
Yeah, I like it. I like watching Smith at the four better than when he plays the three.
Who'd they draft? Caldwell Pope?
Caldwell Pope, who could knock down shots from the outside. And he has size, too. He's 6'6". He's a big boy.
Yeah, I mean, if he pans out and you when you go small ball, Drummond's going to take a seat. Or even if it doesn't matter which one he plays center, but Drummond or Monroe at center, Smith at the four, Caldwell Pope at the three, Knight at the one. I mean, I guess you have to go with Stuckey at the two. I really, really think they need a shooter.
They
really don't have much shooting on that team. J.J. Redick would have been nice. Even
beautiful. He would have been great.
Would have been nice. But we'll see.
And now they signed that Italian shooter who plays small forward, who was the MVP at 25 years old. And he went to the finals. He took his team to the finals as, like, the leading scorer in everything and won the MVP with his efforts, too. And he's a great shooter, plays small forward. His name is Luigi Datome. I believe that's how you pronounce his last name, or Datome.
Like his name.
And his first name is Luigi. And he's a proven scorer from the outside.
I'm so glad we have a Luigi in the NBA.
That's awesome.
I love that name, right? Mario and Luigi. Great Italian names. I'm Italian. So it makes me feel happy.
It's
a good thing to have in the NBA, right?
More shooting the better for Detroit. They're going to have to spread the floor with that front court.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge front court. Oh, my gosh.
So much size. And that's probably their biggest advantage right now in opposing squads and something that they lacked in previous seasons. And now I believe they're better defensively. They can start Smith at the three and get it done defensively because he's a great defender. But he's not a versatile forward when it comes to playing the three offensively because his shooting touch and his stroke is not there from outside. He's a 30% career shooter from three-point range, and that's not getting it done consistently enough, like you said, to stretch it and to force opposing defenses to take you seriously when you're starting Smith at the three and then Monroe at the four and Drummond at the five. You're losing something offensively.
Definitely, but I like Smith. I mean, he's been the best player or almost the best player on, six straight playoff teams, something like that.
Teams that usually lost in the first round, though. But maybe with a better quality supporting cast around him, which the Pistons are starting to build, maybe eventually they get past the first round in Motown with Smith. As their star player, I guess you could say. Or at least number two guy.
I mean, he's consistently like 17 points, 8 rebounds, shoots, I don't know, 45%-ish around there, maybe 47. Oh, I love what they did with him. I think people underrate him and don't get him what he deserves because he takes, a few bad jump shots a game or something like that.
He does.
But
he definitely does, yep.
But I
think trigger-friendly.
It definitely works.
He is.
Yeah, he's got the green light on him. But I still like what they did. I think Detroit will definitely vastly improve since last year.
I believe they're up there now and a contender for a playoff spot in the East. And like you said, Smith averaged 17 a game. In terms of points and 8 boards a game, too, last year. And for his career, his 9-year stint with his hometown Hawks, he averaged 15 a game and around 8 boards a game. So he does a little bit of everything to a good high level, but nothing like overabundantly, nothing tremendously great. But still, he's an all-star caliber forward, and we haven't had that type of player since Billups left Motown when he was dealt for AI back in the 08-09 season.
Definitely. He's a good passer, too. The last 2 years, he's averaged over a little over 4 assists a game. Out of a big man, that's pretty good.
Jordan.
Yeah?
If right now, if you had to pick those last 3 playoff teams in the East, who would you give them to?
Oh, man, the last 3 playoff teams in the East. I think Washington can make it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Who finished in the bottom 3 last year? What were they?
I know the Bucks did. They were the 8th seed,
yeah,
the Bucks.
Yeah, the Bucks.
But they lost Redick. They lost Monte Ellis.
Yeah,
they might lose Brandon Jennings.
Yeah, I think the Bucks are out for sure.
Yep.
You have the Raptors, the Pistons, the Magic.
I don't think the Magic will make it. I think the Cavs are definitely.
How about Jordan Charlotte Bobcats? They added Al Jefferson, the biggest free agent acquisition, right, in the Jordan era, as president of the Bobcats.
Definitely. Hey, Al Jefferson's good. I think his stats will even improve this year because he's going to get so many touches. I mean, they have nobody else who can score on that team. When the possession clock gets low, they're just going to dump it into him. And he does draw a double team, too. So if they got a couple shooters in there, he can definitely help them.
I definitely like the Cavs. Yeah, I think Cleveland, Washington, and Detroit.
Yeah, I agree. I hope Washington gets in it. I like watching John Wall. I think he'd be fun to watch in the playoffs.
I like Bradley Beal, too.
And Otto Porter now, too. Hometown connection with Georgetown.
Yeah, they got a little squad building over there.
They do. They definitely do. And I believe my Pistons do now as well. But I see them guys barely missing out on the postseason by about 4 games or so in the Eastern Conference. And also winning 35 games in the process, which is a good improvement on last season. Only winning 29, around 30, and now winning 35. That's a 5-game improvement at least from last season. And they haven't been a team to win 30-plus since they won 39 back in 08-09 when they lost in the first round to the LeBron James-led Cavaliers and were swept in that series, too, by the Cavs.
Vito, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you want them to make the playoffs, or would you prefer they be in this lottery with this loaded draft?
I think because of that, what you just said about the loaded lottery at the top of the draft next year, I would rather see them miss out. And anyways, if you make it as the 8th seed, which is most likely what they would make it as at this point until they make a deal for a proven starting point guard, they're not going to get out of the first round. They're going to get swept once again, maybe win one game if Smith and their bigs go off or something. And if Billup has a historic performance from the past, it looks like Big Shot again. But honestly, they're going to be a first-round exit if they make it. So, yeah, I'd rather see them miss out and get a nice lottery pick and maybe get higher than the 8th spot in the draft for once. Because it seems like they've been picking 8 overall almost every season in recent memory. It's worked out in the past, maybe not in this past draft, but, hey, last year with Drummond, the year before, too, getting Nye, getting Monroe in past drafts, it's worked out for them. And Jody has really turned it around drafting-wise because he really was bad. During the good years of the Pistons back in the early to mid-2000s, he was making bad draft picks. Oh, my gosh, yeah. Think about what they could have had, and they drafted Darko Milicic. What did he ever do in his career? And he just recently retired.
Darko.
Yeah, that didn't work out.
Yeah, that was a great pick, right? What a bust.
But maybe they could pick up I know, Kyle, you know a lot more about the upcoming draft than I do. But maybe Detroit can get that shooter they need in the draft this year.
Yeah, if you pick 8 this year, you can get one of the Harrison boys from Kentucky. That'd be big. If you get a little higher, Marcus Smart from Oklahoma State would be a nice pick. Obviously Wiggins or Julius Randle would be nice picks. There's going to be a lot of shooters in next year.
How about Jabari Parker too?
Yeah, Jabari Parker. He's probably more of a Josh Smith type clone than a shooter. But I mean, if you pick 8 again next year, you're going to get a good player at 8.
Definitely. And you still got Chauncey next year. You guys signed him to a 2-year deal, I think, right?
Yep. 2 years, $5 million. Correct.
Yeah, so I mean, he could help mentor a new the new shooter or the new guard you got coming in from the draft for next year as well.
Now, what grade do you guys give the Pistons for their moves made this offseason? I think it's near an A.
Me too. I agree. I really like what they did.
I'd give it a B. Anytime you can convince top 20 player like Josh Smith to come to Detroit, that's obviously huge. But I would have liked, and maybe they still do, I would like to see him make one more move, maybe move one of those two front court guys to see if they could get a star point guard like I know Rondo's been mentioned. Or I would have liked him to see maybe open up the wallet a little bit more to go get a J.J. Redick or O.J. Mayo. I think that would have been huge.
I would have loved to have seen the addition of J.J. Redick. Now, that's the guy that can stretch it and knock down long-distance three-pointers. They don't have that type of player at guard right now on their roster. But it's still a team in the Pistons that have won in the past under Joe D. And have a promising future, I believe, that they're building towards as of right now as well. So I like what I'm seeing by Joe D.
I don't think that Rondo thing's off the deal, off the table. Tell me if you think this could happen. Boston goes like 8-20 or so in their first 28 games. They bring Rondo back, play him 5-10 games to prove to the rest of the league that he's still a top point guard. And then Ainge sends him off so they can be ready for the draft.
Yeah, I
believe they're waiting to move him until closer to the deadline, guys, when they can get more quality assets in return for him.
Yeah,
I think the Pistons can have one of the best, can build one of the best deals for him, though. One of the best packages.
I mean, I think Danny Ainge.
Stucky and Monroe, right, as the leading pieces of a deal for Rondo.
Yeah, probably have to throw a pick in, too.
I'm sure Ainge wants him to be terrible up until Rondo comes back. Rondo comes back, kills it, so the rest of the league knows he's still good. Then he trades him off at a high value.
Mm-hmm. Would it make sense for sure for Ainge and the Celtics? Now, looking at another franchise that has been a great team in the past, rich in tradition, in your L.A. Lakers real quick once again. And, Jordan, you saw the Lakers amnesty Ron Artest, or the artist formerly known as Ron Artest, a few days ago.
I'm a big Ron fan.
Was that a good move by Mitch Kupchak, or no?
I mean, it was strictly to save money. The team's not going to be better, or they're not going to pick up a better guy because they've amnestied him. I saw they're set to make about $100 million in revenue this year. I think they could have splurged and kept Meta for another year. Nick Young's probably going to start at the three now, but I still wish they kept Meta for sure.
Kyle, what do you think about it?
Yeah, Kyle, I think might have a different opinion.
Yeah, I think Meta sucks. Jordan knows.
Done over this.
Jordan knows.
He's no longer the same player, right?
No, he's an okay defender. He obviously can't guard people like he used to. Jordan will deny it now, but last year he got so frustrated when he tried to act like 2004 on Artest and get up on people, and they just go right around.
Oh yeah, but he goes up and guards people 5 feet above the 3-point line. It's not the same anymore.
And I mean, he's a decent shooter. Going back to my plan, I think they should have kept him just so they could have been as bad as possible. But if you're trying to win and you amnesty him, that's fine. You probably need to do more than Nick Young to make up for it, though. But we'll see.
Yeah, it's not going to make up for it at the three spot. Not in their starting lineup.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think the Clippers in the same town had a very good offseason.
Yeah, they may get Meta.
I thought he said
how about those Clippers adding Redick and Jared Dudley? Shooters to spread that team offensively.
Darren Collison.
They also got Darren Collison. If you look at his per 36-minute stats compared to Eric Gordon, they're pretty much the exact same player. You really can't, get any closer than what they have. They both averaged per 36, 14 points, 6 assists, about 2 turnovers. So I think he fits in perfectly.
He's a former Pacer, and I mean, there was times.
I thought he looked
really
good with the Pacers, too.
Yeah.
I think he
fills Bledsoe's
hole perfectly.
Yeah, and he'll. And then I saw Stephen A. You got to take his sources with a grain of salt, but he said.
Stephen A. Smith, right?
Yeah, he said he's choosing between the Clippers because he wouldn't have to move, stay in the same building and everything, or going back to his hometown Knicks. If I'm looking at those two situations and I'm him, I'm just staying in the same building and going to the Clippers.
Or you know what? Maybe Artest just goes into acting or does something else. You know, he has all these crazy tweets from time and time that make you think
or
that,
a
maybe.
Rap album. He could probably
yeah, maybe he'll just do that
out.
And just retire. Why not?
Yeah, he's weird. He's weird.
Yeah.
I know he was tweeting pictures of himself, like, hiking around yesterday. He had a bunch of Knicks gear on.
He's crazy, though. I mean, that might be a clear-cut sign that he's going to the Knicks, or the direct opposite of it, that he's not going to play for the New York Knicks. So you never know with that guy.
Just like that Kaepernick thing, Artest wore Knicks hats on the Lakers, and he was just like, yeah, like, I play for the Lakers, but I'm a big Knicks fan. I'm from New York, and no one thought anything of it.
Kaepernick never said he was, like, a fan. Artest just straight out came out and said he was a fan.
Fan of the Knicks,
I like the Knicks. He's like, I'm going to play just as hard, but, like, I'm from New York. I'm a Knicks fan.
If you're employed by an NBA squad, you should not be wearing opposing team's gear, regardless if it's a hat or whatever it is. This doesn't look good.
You shouldn't be punching the customers. You shouldn't be drinking at halftime, but that's just what you get from the guy.
He's Artest, right? And that's why named Metta World Peace, when he's really the direct opposite of that as well. I know he's calmed down in recent memory. I mean, it's been a long time since the malice at the Palace, from that brawl and what happened there with the Pacers and Pistons. But still, he's a guy, we saw him elbow J.J. Barea. What was that, 2 seasons ago? And that was that was Bynum. Was it Bynum that did that?
Yeah,
that was
that was Andrew, right?
Somebody, though. Elbow somebody.
Yes, he did do that.
It's James Harden.
Yes, James Harden.
Correct.
Well, that's
at the end of the season, right?
He stole the ball, went down. He claimed he dunked on the whole team. And then he was just going a little beast mode
afterward.
And James Harden was too close to him.
Yeah, I don't get the guy. He's trouble.
Yeah.
You know what? Maybe he means well and everything. You know what? He maybe can knock down a few shots here and there still. Maybe play defense for about 24 seconds. Every so often, but on a consistent every possession basis, he's not that same type of defender anymore. Maybe a quality reserve at this point in his career, but honestly, not too much of a starter. Not for a contending squad.
Definitely not. I think he's worth the veteran minimum, though. It's like $1.3 million, I think.
Yeah, I would give him that.
Yeah, for sure.
He's worth that, yeah, for sure. For sure. Now, Kyle, any more thoughts about the crazy man that is Metta World Peace real quick?
Nope. I think we wrapped up Indiana Ron pretty well.
Yeah, I would say so. Well, thank you very much, Jordan, for your time today.
He's going to be missed. Thanks. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, man.
Hope to be back on soon. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
See you later.
See
you. Thank you very much. Kyle O'Connor still on the show with me on the third episode of 5 Wide Sports Live on the Sports Geeks Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. And Kyle, let's transition now to some MLB talk. And we're almost at the All-Star break now with the festivities starting on Monday night with the Home Run Derby and actually this Sunday, too, with the Celebrity Softball Game and the Futures Game between the world and the U.S.'s best minor league players, the best prospects in the world. From the U.S. and from the likes of other countries, such as Venezuela, Mexico, all these other countries around the world. And that starts tomorrow. But first, looking at some of the numbers of these players from the first half of the season. Miguel Cabrera, the Tigers' third baseman, has been epically good this whole entire first half, Kyle. He has a major league leading 131 hits, 95 runs batted in, a .367 batting average. And with those numbers, Kyle, he's been good enough to become the first player with 30 home runs and 90 ribbies before the All-Star break. But is he the first half AL MVP? Or is it Mr. Chris Davis of the Baltimore Orioles, their first baseman, who has a major league leading 35 bombs right now, the fourth most before the All-Star break in major league history? What's your take on all that, Kyle? Who is it right now, Cabby? From the Tigers or Chris Davis or the Orioles?
I think what I would do and what most people do would probably be different. I would still probably lean toward Cabrera. And that, like you said, they're pretty close in everything. The only reason I would give him the edge is, you know, at a .313 clip batting average compared to a .367, that's a pretty big difference for me. And then other than that, it would be the on-base percentage. I'd probably even look at that more than batting average. Cabrera is getting on at a .457 clip, which is just absolutely unbelievable at this. I mean, that's almost every other time he's getting on base. While Chris Davis is good at .390, it's not .457. So I still lean toward Cabrera. Like you said, RBIs are close. Cabrera's 7 ahead. Home runs is 5. Runs, Cabrera has more. So I'd give it to him. I assume if we had a vote to end today just to be something different, most people would probably give it to Chris Davis, you know, just to mix it up a little bit, kind of like when Derrick Rose won that MVP, so LeBron didn't get all of them. But I'd give my vote to Miguel Cabrera.
Does Davis mean more to his ball club in the Baltimore Orioles than what Cabby means to the Tigers? I believe perhaps because the pitching of the O's is weaker, so they really need that offensive bat in the middle of that lineup for the Orioles that drives in those runs at a premium rate, like Davis has done all first half long.
I'd agree with that, but you still see, even with what Chris Davis is doing, he's still getting pitches to hit. Guys are still challenging more often, whereas with Miguel Cabrera, the whole reason that offense goes is because of him. He gets very little to hit and still does what he does, but it opens things up for the other hitters. It's huge for Prince. And by him not getting pitches to hit, you know, he'll walk a lot, which he does. And, you know, the more baseball is a simple game, the more guys on base, the better chance you have to score. So I think you could argue either one does more for their team, but I think the ripple effects of what each guy brings is greater with Cabrera.
And Cabrera's a leader in so many offensive categories, too, in the entire league, including total bases, base percentage. I know Davis has the edge in slugging, but that's probably barely as well. He's barely on top of Cabby in that regard.
Yeah,
so Cabby's got all the offensive categories, right, that he needs. And defensively, when you look at the matchup between the two, honestly, Davis is not much better in the field than Cabby is. So it's not like Davis has a huge edge on him defensively, like Trout did last year with his glove in center field and playing all the outfield positions.
Exactly. And the way I look at it, you know, I was okay with those who said Trout last year because, you know, Trout, if you want to look at a complete game, he did have a much bigger advantage defensively as far as helping his team, whereas that's not the case with Chris Davis.
I don't even know if he's better defensively, to be honest.
No.
I don't really know.
I agree. And, you know, so you're looking at pretty much two one-dimensional players, which evens it up, which is what made the Cabrera and Trout argument, you know, real interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of apples and oranges, whereas when you're arguing Cabrera and Davis, it's apples and apples. Yeah, it makes it a little easier. And, like I said, Cabrera's walk a lot more. And, you know, I'm one of the new school guys with baseball. I just get on base, and eventually good things are going to happen. And that's all Cabrera does. I mean, that on base percentage is insane.
And with these two guys, like you said, their MVP caliber seasons are both based on offensive numbers. And right now, looking at the stats, Cabby has the better offensive numbers in every category possible, besides for a few here and there where he trails by 5 in home runs and also slugging percentage by a few points here and there. So Cabby has it. He's been the more dominant all-around offensive player this season in the middle of the order for the Tigers, even more than Chris Davis. And Davis has been terrific for the O's and definitely deserves some votes. But right now it has to be Cabby's award to win, which would mean a back-to-back MVP award for Cabby, and deservedly so, for his efforts in the American League with the Tigers in back-to-back seasons, winning the Triple Crown last year and on pace for it right now as well, just trailing Davis, as I said, in a few categories. If he does get the Triple Crown again, how good of a ball player, when we look back at the career of Miguel Cabrera, will we say that he was for the Tigers?
I mean, the thing with that is, he's kind of at the point right now to where, if you want to compare cross sports with LeBron, I mean, you can start putting them places historically. Thing is, they're not even close to being done. And especially, you know, someone like Cabrera, that's a hitter, we've seen hitters last a long time. And, you know, you'd have to start ranking them up there historically. You know, if you get back-to-back Triple Crowns, just be insane. And he's just going to keep hitting. I mean, he has no signs of slowing down. So anything right now would be speculative, in my opinion. And, you know, he'll just keep rising and rising. What he's doing at the plate is pretty incredible historically.
And the best hitter in the last decade, I saw the numbers a few days ago, comparing Albert Pujols' numbers in the last decade to Miguel Cabrera's. They are eerily similar to each other. Surprising me, because I thought Pujols was heads and shoulders above Cabby in his offensive categories. But Pujols, when compared, stat for stat, very close between the two. And Cabby even held the advantage over Pujols in some areas. Which begs the question now, has he been the best slugger of the past decade in both leagues, Kyle, and even better than Pujols as well?
You know, last decade, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but just going off the top of my head, I'd probably still give a slight edge to Pujols. But I think 5 years from now, when you look at the last 15 years, it won't even be close.
No.
And Cabrera will blow him out of the water by that point. Which is why I said, you know, we still have time to wait on Cabrera. Last decade, you know, Pujols has had so many big hits. He had some monster seasons. But, you know, it's
and he's a World Series
point.
Winner, a multiple
right.
champion,
right.
which Cabby
right.
can't say yet.
Correct. And at this point, though, it's pretty obvious that Pujols is slowing down.
Yep.
And it's pretty obvious that Cabrera is not going to be slowing down anytime soon.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing regression in Pujols and his numbers at the plate. Just regression all around. Barely can even stay in the field on a consistent basis as well at this point. Which is sad to say when you saw him get it done defensively too for so many years and be a great slugger all around at the plate. But that is no more with Pujols. He is nearing the decline era of his career. And I think we're seeing that more and more out of him as time goes on. Now he's heated up a little bit of late along with Hamilton. But Pujols and Hamilton still have been major disappointments for the L.A. Angels of Anaheim. Now, if those two guys get it turned around, though, for the Angels, can the Angels make a push for the postseason in the second half and at least get in as one of the two wildcard teams in the AL?
Are you asking if I think they will?
Do you think they will turn it around? If Hamilton can even get better in the second half, really have a second-half turnaround, a resurgence, along with Pujols at the plate, can they get into the postseason? What's your take
on
that?
I don't think so. I mean, look at the wild card standings right now. You have Texas, Tampa, Baltimore, even the Yankees, Cleveland's up there. You know, Toronto will be sneaking back up. I think there's too many teams, and I don't think they'll be consistent enough. At this point in their careers, Hamilton, Pujols, they're just not consistent bats anymore.
No.
And that's why you're going to see they're going to go through dry spells at times. You know, Trout will obviously be the constant. But, I mean, even though Pujols has got hot, if you compare him to Cabrera, Cabrera's almost doubled him in every stat, and he's hitting 100 points higher. I mean, that's pretty crazy when you say when Pujols has had a decent season. He hasn't had a good season. He's had a decent season. And then Hamilton's been doing what he does, but I don't think their pitching will be consistent enough. I don't think
no.
their bullpen will be consistent enough. I don't think they get into the playoffs no matter how hot those two get.
Yeah, the rotation and pitching staff as a whole is not good enough outside of Jared Weaver at the top of the rotation. He's an ace-caliber frontline starting pitcher for the Halos. Now, behind him, though, in that rotation, very shaky to say the least. Even C.J. Wilson at times. Honestly, I believe he's not a strong number two. I think he would be a great middle-of-the-rotation arm, but for what they're paying for him to be that number two, he is not worth it. He is not deserving of all that money that they committed to him over the long term. And as a result of that, they're taking a hit as a ball club, and their rotation and entire pitching staff as a whole has, as well, in my opinion, Kyle.
Yeah. Yeah, they have too much money and guys that aren't getting it done. And the thing is, baseball teams keep doing this, and we've seen them just basically slowly decay. And I don't understand why teams keep doing it that way. The Marlins did it and had a fire sale. I mean, our two teams, though they're at different points in the path, they did it similar. The Tigers, maybe, you know, 5-6 years ago said, we're going to get younger guys. We're going to build up through the system. Look where they're at now.
And now when Theo's come to Chicago with the Cubs, he's doing the exact same thing. He's taking advantage of the international slots. He's loading up on high-talent guys in the draft and paying them whatever he has to do. And, you know, hopefully in 5-6 years, they're at the point to where the Tigers are now. And we've seen the Giants are another team like that when they're winning titles. We've seen teams use that formula over and over to win games. Yet these teams in big money markets and such, they just want to keep throwing money at guys that are past their primes, and it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, luckily it's worked out for the Tigers in recent memory, signing B-Mark to that big deal. Prince Fielder, even J.U.B. in recent memory. Scherzer is due up for a contract extension, too, in the very near future. Cabrera signed a big one, long-term. So luckily it's worked out in their long-term deals.
You know?
Yeah.
With Fasoli, Austin Jackson, you know, they got in on young. Even guys that they've moved, but even the guys that they got young that they've moved, they've brought back talent for them. And that's the formula that works, and not everyone seems to get it.
And making good trades, too, from their farm system, trading a guy, a top rotation arm like Jacob Turner from the farm, to acquire Anibal Sanchez for the rotation, a top of the rotation arm, and Omar Infante as a bat that can stabilize the bottom of the lineup and stabilize that second base position, which was a major hole in their lineup, and defensively all season long last year for the Tigers, starting the likes of Ryan Rayburn, Santiago there way too often, Danny Wirth even. And now they upgraded that with Infante, who's on the 15-day DL right now, and that's the topic for another day, along with him and Peralta. A 50-game suspension maybe for Peralta being in his near future and messing up the Tigers and what they have in the middle of the infield going forward in the second half of this season. But as I said, that's a story for another day with the Tigers. But looking back at Dombrowski once again, the deals he's pulled off, Kyle, he's made it happen. He hasn't made many bad deals for the Tigers where you look back at the deal and say, man, did the Tigers lose out big time? You really can't say that with Dombrowski in his tenure as the president and GM of the Tigers. The only one that's close to that would have been Renteria until recently because Jared Jurgens, look at what he's done recently. He looked very good before injuries occurred for him in Atlanta. He looked like maybe that John Smoltz type of player that the Tigers gave up and missed out on. But now on the Orioles, struggling to get healthy and struggling to be a consistent starting pitcher on a regular basis. And as a result of that, I don't see many bad deals that have been pulled off in the tenure of Dave Dombrowski as GM and president of the Detroit Tigers. And that's definitely a good thing to say as a fan of the Tigers. And I believe even me as a fan can say that. And that's saying something because, you know, as a fan, I could be biased. But I think even an unbiased fan or just an outsider of the Tigers organization, such as yourself, Kyle, could back me up with that sentiment shared by myself and many Tigers fans regarding Dombrowski and the deals he's made the past 3, 4, 5 seasons since he took over the Tigers. So dating back to 05, 2004, and all those bad years, too, when he first took over.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing it the correct way. Surprisingly, there's probably only 10 GMs that are doing it right now. And the rest are kind of scrapping at what used to work or what never worked and for some reason people think works. But the smarter teams, more progressive teams, the teams with better GMs, they're going to keep winning games. And that's just the way it's going to be. Like you said, the Tigers are that way. The Red Sox still have smart people in their front office. Oakland, obviously, Texas, and then some teams that are on the up and coming, you know, like the Cubs and the Reds.
Yeah.
The Padres have some good people in that front office. And, you know, teams like that tried it the other way and it's not working. Angels, Yankees.
The Dodgers, both LA ball clubs.
Marlins, Dodgers.
Yeah.
You know, it's two different sides of the equation, but one side seems to keep getting all the World Series championships.
And now the Cubs are finally doing it right with Theo Epstein as their GM or as their president of operations. And now they're looking great for the future. And you definitely like what they're doing. So talk about that
yeah.
a little bit. And how about those tradable assets they have, too, as the trade deadline nears with Matt Garza being a big trade piece. Also Soriano, to a large degree, I would say, bearing what you think about his contract and that mess of a deal that they have on the books.
Yeah, they they're still a couple years away. They're still going to be okay the next couple of years, but they are just absolutely loading up on young talent, and especially international talent. I was talking with someone else the other day. It almost seems like Theo's the only person that understands how this international pool works. I mean, he has just taken complete advantage of this. You know, a lot of his trades, he's getting slot money back. And, you know, through the draft, they've been taking high upside guys that are going to be more expensive, and they've just been paying them. They got Chris Bryant, who had, you know, over 30 home runs in the college season. They finally got him signed yesterday. Big money, but, you know, if he's going to be a cornerstone over there at third, pay it to him. It's pennies compared to, you know, what he could end up meaning to the team. They're stockpiling young arms. When they move,
about Justin Marcia, he's been great all year long. Besides for one start, maybe his most recent outing, in which he kind of got rocked and hit hard. But besides for that, great numbers for him.
He's been fantastic, and Travis Wood this year is going to be
out of nowhere. Never hear about
him. He's an all-star. He made the all-star team. And he'll bring back a nice package at the deadline. Garza will obviously bring back even more young talent. And then you look, Soriano probably won't bring back a lot of talent, but he will bring back relief on the cap, which you can go out and then sign another guy. Someone like David DeJesus could bring back a decent package. You know, and then their young cornerstones of Castro, Rizzo, Castillo, Samardzija. Those are just the guys at the major league level, and then they're loaded at the minors. You know, I'm okay with waiting a couple more years with an okay team to where if in a few years they're competing in the playoffs. I'm okay with waiting. Cubs fans have waited long enough. A few more years won't be an issue.
Yeah, it won't hurt. A true Cubby fan, right, can deal with more losing because, hey, you've dealt with it for how many years now? 100-plus seasons, though, and all of your lifetime. So you can deal with a few more to build a quality product for the long-term future. As Theo Epstein seems to be doing that for the Cubbies in Chicago right now. And doing it internationally, too, spending money smartly through that and getting some guys because of it. Another team, though, looking at the international spending of late, has done it right, or at least with one ball player of their own in the Dodgers, with Yasiel Puig. Look at the numbers he's put up, some monster numbers in his rookie campaign, being up in the big leagues now for about a month and a half to 2 months, and still producing on a pretty much regular basis as a starting outfielder for the Dodgers, who can get it done in the field, too, with his glove, and he has a cannon of an arm as well on top of it, which begs the question, Kyle, should he, with his numbers thus far, and the great revenue he's produced for the MLB and Dodgers, should he have been, because of that, an all-star for the NL this year, representing the National League and the LA Dodgers in the 2013 All-Star Game? What's your take on that?
Yeah, he absolutely should have been an all-star. My issue with that is, with baseball, there's getting to be, especially, you know, younger kids like us, there's getting to be less and less purists and, you know, just basically big fans. He's the kind of guy you need to get kids excited again. I mean, he's the guy that's going to go up there. He's going to be charismatic. He's going to pound balls at the plate, be flying around in the field. Those are the kind of guys, you know, people like him, Harper, Trout. Those are the guys we need to have at the forefront of the game right now, basically just to, you know, ratchet the interest back up a little bit in the post-steroid era and just get people excited about baseball again. And, you know, the Midsummer Classic is, you know, that's the biggest time where you're going to have eyeballs. You know, even if it's not at the game themselves, at some point in All-Star Weekend, there's going to be people watching the festivities. And a guy like Puig is someone you need front and center. I would have loved to seen him on the team, but, you know, there's always so much you can do about it. The Braves fans, you know, Braves fans are a special group. For winning so many division titles in a row, they still have a little brother syndrome. And
yeah, they do,
Probably because of the media markets. You have the Mets, you have D.C., you have Philly in that division. But, man, they just get angry, and they got angry enough to put Freeman in through the final vote, so power to them.
And no diehard fans still for that fan base after 14 straight NL East division titles. And now they have a great young ball club right now with their pitching staff, the Upton brothers, Freddie Freeman, Brian McCann at catcher. They're producing winning ball games and in the lead of the NL East division, a tougher division, and still not the greatest fan base. But they got Freddie Freeman into the All-Star game. Good to see for them. And he deserved it. 27 extra base hits this year, or 27 games where he had multiple extra base hits. I believe 18 for Puig with the Dodgers. So Freeman's put up consistently good numbers, and he's been up with the big league ball club all year long, unlike Puig. So maybe he got in and was more deserving of it than Puig was. And I think looking at those specific numbers, which I brought up, Kyle, maybe he was indeed.
Yeah.
And he was in first place, so they deserve to have a couple of All-Stars, right?
Yeah. I mean,
and he's been really their best hitter all year long for a first-place team.
Yeah. His big argument is that he played the whole season, and that's understandable. But the All-Star game is never – unlike, let's say, the NBA All-Star game, because fans want to vote in the starters there too. With the NBA All-Star game, a lot of times you'll see a deserving player will get in the reserves. You'll have the deserving guys, you know, someone like Drew Holiday last year who was good for half the season. He deserved to be at that point. With baseball, it's never really been like that. It's really just been a time to showcase the biggest stars and, you know, basically just put on a good show. That's where I would have liked to see Puig, but if we're, you know, Freeman, you can't argue with him deserving to be there.
Mm-hmm. And with the international star in Puig, can the Dodgers turn it around enough in the second half to win the division in the NL West? It seems like to me the division is weak enough all around from 1 through 5, Kyle, that the Dodgers can pull it off. And they're right there right now and really have been red hot because of, or in large part due to Puig and what he's brought to that team on an any given day basis, too, for the Dodgers.
Yeah, I think health is going to be big for L.A. If they can stay healthy, they can absolutely make a run for that division. It's just going to be, you know, we got to see, you know, Puig got a little dinged up there. And then from there, it's going to be their bats, you know, with Kemp and them staying healthy. And then people, you know, they have some fragile arms also that they're going to have to keep healthy. You know, health permitting, they don't have to stay completely healthy, but, you know, they stay relatively healthy. They'll make a run, like you said, that is kind of a weaker division this season. And I haven't looked at the odds lately, but I'd have to think they have decent odds at this point in Vegas to win that division.
Now, Kyle, transitioning from one team rich in tradition in L.A. to the Yankees, the Bronx Bombers. Now, not so much this year, though, in New York for the Yankees. Not as much of home run hitting production for that team. And probably rightfully so with all their injuries being pretty much decimated by injuries all season long. Up and down that lineup, 1 through 9, outside of Robinson Cano, the steady hitter in the middle of that order, who is an all-star at second base. Also, the home run derby captain for the American League this season at Citi Field, when that is played on Monday night. But beside that point, Derek Jeter has come back, the Yankee captain, to play shortstop. Got hurt in his first game back to the big leagues yesterday, pulling a quad muscle. And due to that, he will be out until at least after the All-Star break. So, did the Yankees then maybe rush him back to the big leagues before he was ready, Kyle, to return to full-time action?
I mean, maybe a little bit. I don't think they would have, you know, purposely rush someone like him back knowing that there would be an issue there for hurting himself again. And if you listen to him say it, you know, the past week or so, he's the one that's been saying, oh, I've been doing this in Tampa. I've been doing this down in Tampa. This is nothing new for me. I just need a game action, and now I'm good to go. You know, if my 15-year captain is telling me he's been doing this, he's good to go, and he tells me he's good to go, my doctors say he's ready, I'm putting him out there. And I think that's what the Yankees did. You know, it's unfortunate he got dinged up again, but if it's minor and he can come back after the break and be fine, it won't be too big of an issue.
Now, he looked limited, though, running the bases. Looked very slow and not like himself. And my opinion is that he can't cover range and do a ton of stuff in the hole playing shortstop right now on a consistent basis. And because of that, I think he's more of a DH right now and a guy that has to split time between DH and shortstop. And that's not the Yankee captain of old. So I believe they're missing something from Jeter going forward, and that he won't be the same Yankee captain for the Yanks in 2013 at least.
Yeah, I mean, if we're being completely honest, he hasn't been able to play short for a while. I mean, he's basically been standing in left field for a couple years now. And then you have the misleading fielding stats where, you look at errors and such. Well, he doesn't get a lot of errors because there's a lot of balls he just doesn't get to anymore.
Get to, yep. But he fields the ones that are hit to him, in my opinion.
Right.
It's the range that he can't cover anymore, like you said. Getting to those balls deep in the hole.
Exactly. He's not, a guy like Asdrubal Cabrera or someone like that, they're going to have more errors, younger shortstops getting Elvis Andrews, Starlin Castro. Those guys are going to have more errors because they're getting to balls that a lot of people can't get to, and they're just trying to make a play. Whereas Derek Jeter is just not getting to those balls, and he's not even giving you a chance. Now you tell me, which shortstop would you rather have? Would you rather have the younger guy that's at least getting there and knocking them down? I'd take that. And that's where
I want a guy who gets to the balls, right? Has some range still.
You have to look at UZR probably a little bit more than fielding percentage. If I'm Derek Jeter, I can stand basically in the outfield and get to the balls hit right at me and only have a couple of errors the whole season and still not be a very good fielder.
Yeah,
so
that's how he makes
up
for it.
You're right. I agree with you. I think you have to keep him out of the field as much as possible, injury or not.
And I believe that covers up for his lack of range and also allows him to be a better, more consistent hitter at the plate, too. A guy that gets it done more for contact and hits better for average than when you start him full-time at shortstop.
Yep, I agree.
And that's the advantage the Yankees have if they play him more often at DH than at short going forward. And it looks like that they might have to anyways this season. Now, the rest of the Yankees ball club, a lesser ball club, talent-wise this season, specifically in their lineup from top to bottom. Now, saying all that, they're at the bottom of their division in the AL East, a tough and balanced division, very competitive, as usual. But can they get back up to the top of that division by the end of the season? And enough so, Kyle, to get back into postseason contention?
Yeah, I think they can. That's another division where nothing would really surprise me. You know, a team like the Jays could get hot and take that division. That wouldn't really surprise me either, to be honest. I didn't expect Boston to be as good as they are. Really didn't expect that. Any of those teams, Baltimore could obviously still take the division. I wouldn't have an issue with anyone predicting any of those teams to win, least of all the Yankees. They still have talent. They have a lot of depleted talent, and they're paying a lot of money to people that aren't helping them win games, but nevertheless, they do still have talent.
Now, we're running over here with the show today, so real quick, Kyle, before I let the two of us go on today's third episode of Five Wide Sports Live on the Sports Geeks Radio Network, let's turn our attention to the Tigers and the White Sox and a mini brawl that they had, or scuffle that they had between each other on Thursday, a day game. At Comerica Park between the Tigers and White Sox. Chris Sale was the starting pitcher on the mound for the White Sox during that game, and he came up and inside a pitch, at least he threw, that ran inside on Prince Fielder, the star slugging first baseman of the Tigers. And it wasn't liked by the Tigers bench and by Leland. And shortly after that, I believe the next half inning, to be exact, Kyle, Luke Pekonen, a relief pitcher for the Tigers, came up and in and hit one of the White Sox batters, leading to a bench clearing from both squads, and Jim Leland coming out, arguing with the umps, and saying, why didn't my ball club get a warning after Sale did what he did? Now, the pitch, I think, just got away. He was overthrowing, and he lost control of it, which is why it ran inside and almost hit Prince Fielder. But Prince didn't like it. Jim Leland didn't like it. And Pekonen thought that he had the right and deserved to throw at the White Sox batter immediately after that, in the next half inning, because of the fact that he thought Sale had all the intention to hit Prince Fielder during that at-bat. Now, because of that, Jim Leland said, like I said, where was the warning? Why didn't my pitcher get a warning before being ejected? And then subsequently, Leland, after three times out fighting and arguing with the umps, verbally attacking them, got ejected himself. And actually, after the first time he did, then he came out another two times, though, to still get his money's worth. Now, saying all that, and maybe after looking at it a few times, Kyle, what would you say about Leland and what he did, his actions on Thursday in that game against the White Sox? Were they appropriate, or did he cross the line?
Are people saying he crossed the line?
See, I think they are because he came out more than once. He came out three times and two times after he was ejected. Because he was ejected after the first time of arguing with the umps, after what
right.
resulted between the Tigers and White Sox.
Right, right.
And they're saying that he crossed the line because of that, Kyle.
Right. I did see that. I wouldn't give any, you know, crap about it. Baseball's a little different. You know, if he wants to come out, especially when he can get talked like that and he feels like he didn't get his 2 cents in, you know, if they're not physically restraining him, let him argue all he wants. I don't have any issue with it. If he wants to sit there and yell till he's blue in the face, I mean, I'm still excited enough for it. I don't care. If people are kind of saying you crossed the line, you know, maybe coming back out, but what I saw, at least with the highlight I saw, he did come back out twice, but it only lasted like 5-6 total minutes, correct? Even coming
it was
back
a very
out.
Short time period, within a 5 to 10 minute time range, yeah.
Yeah.
So not like he came back out two more times, you know, 10 or 15 minutes after the fact. It wasn't like that.
Yeah, I don't have any
Well, I don't know what. Do you think he crossed the line?
Well, you know what? He's an older gentleman. He wanted to get his money's worth. Maybe he forgot to say something to the umps the first time and went back out there. And he felt his team got lowballed, that his team got slighted because of the fact that they weren't warned after Chris Sale did what he did against Prince Fielder. Threw up and in. Nothing happened. No warning as a result of that. And then Luke Piccone, to get revenge for his ball club, to kind of defend Prince Fielder, he went out there and threw inside and hit a White Sox batter because he thought Chris Sale had the intention, all the intention in the world to hit Prince Fielder during that at-bat when he almost did. And as a result, Piccone threw up inside and hit the White Sox batter. But there was no warning before his ejection. And because of that, Jim Leland felt his team was slighted because it's part of protocol. It's a rule for all umps, right? For every single game that they ump, to warn both clubs, both sides after an incident, such as Chris Sale's with Prince Fielder. And no warning was given by the umps, by any ump, during that game on Thursday afternoon. That's where I felt that they crossed the line, where they didn't take care of proper protocol. They didn't follow the rules as properly as they should have. And because of that, Leland had all the right in the world to be angry and to defend his ball club, to defend Piccone for doing something that he felt was very righteous, or at least had had some reasoning behind it.
Yeah, if there was no warning given, Leland has every right to be upset. And like I said, even if he came back out, if it only lasted 5 to 10 minutes, you know, I've seen Lou Piniella last 15, 20 minutes without ever coming
mm-hmm.
back out. So I have no problem with it. If it's not slowing up the game too much, let him argue.
He had every right to be angry. His ball club, like I said, got slighted. They weren't taken care of by the umps. The umps let the situation get out of control. And really, it hurt the ball club that day, too. The Tigers lost 6-3, and maybe it hurt the ball club, I think, at that point in time when it happened. Piccone had to come out of the game. And it wasn't the right or perfect situation for the Tigers, obviously, in that ball game. Leland already had left Anibal Sanchez in the ball game a pitch or two too long. And as a result of that, Sanchez gave up a Grand Slam home run to one of the White Sox rookie hitters. And then the White Sox took the lead as a result of that Grand Slam. And Leland, I think, was boiling over because of that. And then what perspired? In the inning after that, the next half inning, when Luke Piccone was thrown out from the game without any proper warning from the umps, that did it. That was all Leland had to see, and he went off, and I believe rightfully so, defending his ball club.
Yep, I agree.
So Leland, I think, did what he had to as a Tiger skipper. And now, you know what? Sale and Leland will make up in the All-Star game on Tuesday night because Sale's pitching for the AL Ball Club, and Leland's a manager for the All-Star team at Citi Field on Tuesday night. And,
right.
Kyle, real quick, who do you have in that ball game, the AL or the NL?
I'm a Cubs fan. So
it's a tough one to ask you, but who would you say right now?
NL.
All righty, how
I'll
about a score, too? How close?
Let's say 9-6.
A close one, then. And you know what? Both really good leagues right now, I believe. I believe the AL is a little bit down, so I see the NL winning as well. And maybe a Cubby will do something. Maybe a Cubby will have an impact on Tuesday night for the NL in their victory. And as a result, I don't believe Mo Rivera will get a chance to close out for his last time in the All-Star game. But it should be fun, and that is on Tuesday night next week at Citi Field in Queens. Right? That's where the Mets play, I believe?
Yep, correct.
So watch that game. I know you will be, and I will as well on Fox Tuesday night, Kyle. Thank you very much for your time today on Five Wide Sports Live. I'll talk to you,
Thanks,
man. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, too. And that was Mr. Kyle O'Connor, Five Wide Sports founder and owner. Great stuff from him as usual. Also, Mr. Jordan Bernstein, a Five Wide Sports NBA contributor. Great NBA insight from him. And a fun time today. Lively banter and everything that I wanted out of today's show. The third episode of Five Wide Sports Live is a wrap. Talk to you next Saturday, same time and same place at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Sports Geeks Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. Have a great weekend, everyone, and talk to you then. Goodbye.